This is The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. An exciting deadline day, but who won the window? And what trophy do you get for that? Some interesting moves. Can Donny van der Beek and Dele Alli remember how to play football at Frank Lampard's Everton? Burn, Target and Wood, not necessarily what Newcastle fans would have been dreaming of a month ago, but are they disappointingly sensible signings? Aubameyang leads Arsenal while Ndombele leaves Spurs, who bring in two Juventus players to the Conte revolution. And what do Jurassic Park and one of the Weasley twins have to do with any of it? And should we be worried about the amount of money spent this time around? In actual football, at AFCON, we look ahead to the semi-finals. Elsewhere, it's the business end of World Cup qualifying all over the world. A lot of excited Canadians have been in touch. There's referees' assistants without flags in South America and some despondent Australians. Before all of that, though, the depressing relationship between domestic sexual violence and football. Is it a subject we talk about enough? How should we cover it? Should players convicted of crimes be able to play again, or is there space for rehabilitation and forgiveness? These are complex questions to which we might not have the answers, but it doesn't mean we shouldn't discuss it. And that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Jordan Jarrett-Bryan, welcome.
Hi, mate. You're right.
Very good. Thank you very much. Ed Ahrens, hello.
Hello, Max.
And Barney Ronay, welcome.
Hi, Max.
Let's begin then with that uncomfortable relationship that football has with sexual violence. I appreciate quite a lot of people listen with their kids. By all means, fast forward to part two if you feel this conversation isn't appropriate. Also to say that we plan to do a special on this in the future, much like the pod we did on misogyny. It clearly needs female voices. Just so happens that today's panel is all male. We didn't intend to or particularly want to talk about these stories today, but we should do. So Mason Greenwood has been bailed following his arrest on suspicion of raping, assaulting and threatening to kill a woman. The 20-year-old remains under investigation. Greater Manchester Police, who've not named Greenwood, put out a statement this morning saying, quote, a 20-year-old man arrested on Sunday the 30th of January 2022 on suspicion of the rape and assault of a woman has been released on bail pending further investigation. Greenwood was arrested on Sunday after police saw a woman reporting claims of physical violence and sexual threats on social media. On Tuesday, he was further arrested on suspicion of sexual assault and making threats to kill. The striker was suspended from playing for or training with Manchester United until further notice after the allegations. A GMP spokesperson said, if you are a victim or concerned about someone you know, please use our online reporting facility or our live chat facility on our website or call 101. In an emergency that's ongoing or life is in danger, always dial 999. A Manchester United spokesperson said, Manchester United reiterates its strong condemnation of violence of any kind. As previously communicated, Mason Greenwood will not train with or play for the club until further notice. Nike released a statement saying, we've suspended our relationship with Mason Greenwood. We're deeply concerned by the disturbing allegations and will continue to closely monitor the situation. As of recording, Greenwood had not responded to the allegations. We can't say too much more on this specific case. We don't know the facts. We do plan on covering it in much more depth when we can. As always, when we cover these issues, there'll be links to relevant charities and helplines in the episode description on our website. Moving on from this, but very connected, is the signing by Raith Rovers of David Goodwillie. Lots of people got in touch to ask us to address this story. The author Val McDermott tweeted yesterday morning, I have this morning ended my lifelong support of Raith Rovers over their signing of the rapist David Goodwillie. I've cancelled next season's shirt sponsorship over this disgusting and despicable move. This shatters any claim to be a community or family club. Goodwillie has never expressed a shred of remorse for the rape he committed. His presence at Starks Park is a stain on the club. I'll be tearing up my season ticket too. This is a heartbreaker for me and many other fans I know. This was followed shortly by the announcement that the captain of Raith Rovers women's team, Tyler Rattray, has quit the club after a decade. She said of the decision to sign Goodwillie, I want nothing to do with it. Rape Crisis Scotland tweeted their support, writing, this has no doubt been an incredibly difficult decision for Val McDermott, but it's one we wholeheartedly support. When it comes to sexual violence, we need zero tolerance. Goodwillie, along with another footballer, David Robertson, was sued for damages for rape by Denise Clare, who waived her right to anonymity in a landmark case in 2017. The pair had not been prosecuted, but the civil court ruled they'd raped Clare after meeting her on a night out in West Lothian in 2011. She was awarded £100,000 in damages. They denied the allegation, appealed against the judgment, but lost. In a statement yesterday evening, the club said, quote, as David has previously played for Raith Rovers earlier in his career, we consider him to be part of the Raith Rovers football club. It said it completely respects differing views on the signing and would continue to engage with fans and stakeholders, going on to say that, quote, while acknowledging the gravity of what happened 10 years ago, as a club, we fully support and encourage rehabilitation, and many factors influenced our signing, but first and foremost, this was a football-related decision. The Raith Rovers director, Andrew Mill, resigned following the signing as well. I mean, I didn't know about this case until yesterday. He'd been playing for Clyde for years. I guess the question then follows, does forgiveness come into this at all? You know, as a liberal, I sort of believe that people deserve a second chance. At the same time, I'm repulsed by the crime. And, you know, should he ever play again for anybody? It's not something that we discussed ever when he was at Clyde. We didn't, because I didn't know. And maybe that's, you know, our fault slightly. But I don't know what you think, Barney.
Well, it's, in a way, it's an interesting case because you can say there's two competing things. I believe that football clubs are community ventures and things that you want to feel a part of in that way. So the idea of it is really repulsive, and I completely understand those fans who don't feel they can support the club. On the other hand, obviously, there's an idea of rehabilitation and forgiveness. The issue here, as Val McDermott pointed out, is he has shown no remorse for, well, I'm not going to call it a crime because he wasn't convicted in a criminal court. So he clearly thinks that he's not guilty. He's the court thinks he's wrong because he appealed and the appeal was refused. It's not relevant strictly, but he also has other convictions for violence, just sort of street violence on a night out. The issue of forgiveness and rehabilitation has to go hand in hand with remorse and regret and earning that forgiveness and rehabilitation, which should definitely exist. I don't believe in throwing away the key. On the other hand, what do we think football is? If you're a teacher, you're not going to work in a school again if you've been convicted of rape. We have high standards for some professions, understandably with things like teaching, because you're constantly in contact with vulnerable people. But you can decide that you simply don't want, you know, go and find another career now. It's not appropriate. Personally, I do believe in forgiveness and in people learning from mistakes they've made. But yeah, it has to go hand in hand with that person acknowledging it and wanting it.
I was just going to say it's been good to see such a strong reaction against it. You know, like, you know, people standing up for what's right, actually. And I think, you know, it's just good to see that the community has got together. Whether it's going to make a difference in the end, I don't know. But, you know, all people can do is express their opinions. And it's good to see that people have done that.
I think, like, issues of, you know, homophobia in football, racism in football, the only way really to kind of fix these evils for me is reputational and financial damage. And I think with the captain leaving the women's team, and sponsors pulling out, those are the two ways that I think you get your message across. I'm also with Barney, though, in that I'm conflicted. I'm a believer in rehabilitation as well. But the problem, again, as Barney says, is that this player and individual hasn't shown any contrition about what he's done. And in his head, he may well feel I've done nothing wrong, so why would I apologise? I get that logic. But there's definitely an uncomfortableness about him not showing any remorse as to moving forward and offering that rehabilitation to that individual.
That's exactly right. I mean, even if he clearly doesn't feel that he's guilty and, you know, he's able to feel that, some acknowledgement that his victim and the court obviously do think that, and that you have to respect that and show some kind of contrition and sympathy. It just feels really strange and odd. Can I just say, on a separate, obviously these topics have happened, we're the pod, we're for men talking about it. I do think men have locus standi to talk about this stuff and should talk about it. Obviously not exclusively and probably not to the extent I'm going on about it, but because it's a male issue, and if men stop doing this, it's going to stop happening. It's not a women's issue. It's like men are the people doing this, and the more men talk about it, that seems like a good thing, as well as obviously the main side of it.
And actually, there's an interesting point that my colleague at TalkSport, Charlie Baker, made, has made on Twitter before about these cases, is talking to your, if you have sons, talking to your sons about having these difficult conversations about consent and things that, you know, you probably presume are totally fine, but the, you know, those serious conversations that if you have sons that you absolutely should have. I finished this part with an email from Innes, a long-time listener of the pod, saying, "Hi, Max and co. I don't know if the pod will be covering the reaction to Raith Rovers' signing of David Goodwillie, but as a lifelong Raith fan, I wanted to write in to express my feelings about it. For context, I've been going to Raith games since my dad started taking me as a boy. I was a season ticket holder for many years before moving away from home. After my father passed away, supporting Raith Rovers took on a more personal meaning, and I think it's fair to say I see supporting this club as a fundamental part of who I am as a person. In light of their decision to proceed with signing Goodwillie in spite of clear objections of ordinary fans and our main sponsor and arguably most prominent fan, Val McDermott, I feel I can no longer support the club. I'm angered and embarrassed at the disdain the board have shown for its supporters and particularly its women supporters and supporters who are survivors of sexual assault. I fully support Val and Tyler Rattray, our now former women's captain, in severing ties with the club and stand with the many fans who will no longer be going to games or financially supporting the team. Rovers present themselves as a community club and the message this sends is incredibly disheartening, that our values are less important than a push for promotion. The amount of damage done in such a short space of time is quite incredible, and the work the club will have to do to repair relations with fans like me, if they are even interested, is already monumental. Sorry for the long rant. I just needed to express how I, and I'm sure how many other fans, are feeling. All the best, Innes." Thanks so much for email. Thanks for everyone for getting in touch. We'll be back in just a minute. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. There's a new Guardian podcast called Weekend, a brand new podcast launching this Saturday, the 5th of February. Listen to celebrity interviews, lifestyle features, opinions from our most popular columnists, including Marina Hyde and John Crace, out every Saturday. You can listen from this Saturday on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Mr. Leonard says, "Not refs or VAR, but at least Barney will get to talk about which team won the transfer window." Barney, you've written a piece on what was on the face of it quite an interesting and exciting deadline, in the sense there were some interesting transfers. But your piece is sort of centred more on this may not be good for football.
Yeah, some negative, depressing kind of take. I don't know. It was just because I woke up and the first thing I saw in the morning was these quotes from Deloitte saying, "It's brilliant. It's a triumph. You know, hooray, open the bottles of champagne. Everything's good again because, you know, football clubs are spending money." Whereas in reality, most of that money, well, actually just about most, was spent by the bottom five clubs who have realised this really isn't the time to fall out of the Premier League. A lot of it was clubs trying to restructure these massive contractual liabilities they have. And I think we should all be really cautious about where wild spending leads us. Plus the fact that this isn't magic money, it comes out of supporters' pockets. Every single penny of it, apart from the stuff which is pumped in by nation states, comes from the pockets and the tickets and the merchandise of you and I. So I don't think it's something that should be just blandly celebrated, even though it's really good fun and I'm desperate to see what happens at Everton. I really want to see their next game so much. And Newcastle is brilliant. Bring it on.
Yeah, I mean, that is the difficulty, though, isn't it? Because I agree with you. And I mean, the whole thing about Everton now, you know, Frank Lampard came. Thank you so much to Richie McCormack, who put the Frank Lampard announcement video to the theme tune to Hollyoaks. It really looked absolutely perfect, didn't it? Donny van der Beek and Dele Alli turn up. Can they play together, Ed?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. It reminds me a bit of when Everton signed seven number 10s a few years back when Rooney came back and they had Davy Klassen, do you remember? Mm. And Sigurdsson. And just too many number 10s. I mean, they're both great players on their day. We'll have to see how they all fit into the side under Frank Lampard. I'm really interested in Dele Alli, how that's going to go, because it's some sort of crazy deal, isn't it? Like, free for the first 20 games and then they play £10 million, and then it's, after that, it could be up to £35 million. It's sort of a very strange structured transfer by the sounds of it. And I mean, Dele Alli is kind of, you think already, even though he's only 25, it's almost like feels like a last chance saloon, isn't it? A little bit going back. And Everton is not really the place you want to be doing that for your career.
It's not the saloon to go into, is it?
Not the saloon to step into.
Martin says, what will Dele Alli have to do for his transfer fee to reach 40 million? Find life on Mars, discover a new renewable energy source, redesign VAR so that everyone agrees with every decision. You know what, Jordan, I watched the 2019 semi-final for Spurs against Ajax a couple of months ago, and he was so good. He was so incisive and graceful and quick and important to that game for Spurs. And I'm totally fascinated. And I thought what was really interesting as well was just quite how emotionally invested Spurs fans were about Dele Alli and the sort of outpouring of emotion for a player who hasn't really been good for a long time.
Well, there is that. And I'm glad you finished on that point there, because people talk about Dele Alli as someone that's had a rough 18 months or so. He's not been good for 3 years. It's actually been about 3 years since he's actually been good. So that's a long time. And I agree with Ed in the sense that for me was the most fascinating transfer of the window for me, because I mean, you say that it's the last chance for him. It is. I think he's done already. I think the sort of player that he is, and which is why Frank Lampard signing him for me is fascinating, because he was a Frank Lampard arriving late into the box, you know, athletic, you know, really good eye for good runs, could finish, could, you know, strike a ball really well and score some goals. The minute Pochettino changed that system and the formation, he found himself out in the cold. And I don't think anyone else plays that sort of shadow striker type role anymore. But Lampard might, because that's what essentially he really was. There was a lot of excitement around the Everton transfer window, but I'm not convinced that actually it was a good window. I'm not convinced Frank Lampard is the right guy for them. That's a very Everton-esque appointment for me. I'm not convinced Donny van der Beek, despite being, I think, a very good player, is going to work out for them. And as I mentioned, I'm not convinced Dele Alli is the player we saw nearly 4 years ago. So for all the hype and excitement around Everton, around who they brought in this month, I'm not convinced that actually, you know, it will be the window. I think they'll stay up, but I don't think it's going to be, I think the excitement is very soon will be punctured and replaced with, oh, why did we sign him? Why did we sign him? Kind of vibes that we often get from Everton supporters.
On Dele Alli, you're right about him being a shadow striker. What I never understood is I watched him a lot in that 2015-16-17 period, and he was brilliant when he played really close to Harry Kane, and they played together, and often Kane would assist for Alli to score. And then going into Euro 2016, I was thinking that's going to be what's going to work for England. Hodgson's going to get those two players. They were brilliant that season. And for some reason, he played them, you know, 40 metres apart. And from that moment, it seemed to fall apart. And I kind of trace it back to then. There was still the incredible Real Madrid game. I was at Wembley for that. And Alli in that game, again, played right up front. I remember him absolutely terrorising Sergio Ramos and just running right across the front line, he destroyed them. I thought, this guy, he keeps playing like that, he's going to be one of the best players in the world. And it seems to be from that moment, pretty much, that he's gone into decline. But I think that there's some positional thing that's gone wrong, and he's completely forgotten or lost that kind of hard edge and that hunger that made him irresistible. I mean, maybe you just can't play that position anymore. Maybe it was a really specific thing that worked for him.
Marvin says, is Arsenal shifting Aubameyang from their wage bill the best signing of the window, Ed?
Again, that was another crazy move, wasn't it? I mean, he had to leave the club and then eventually signed 24 hours later for Barcelona, having waived the best part of £25 million from his 18 months left on his mega contract. It's a good piece of business financially for Arsenal, I suppose. They've saved that money. But then on the other hand, you know, they've lost one of their key player, their captain, and it's happened so quickly. I mean, that's a good, in a way, it's a positive, because they've resolved the situation, they've got the money back. But the management of Arsenal, you know, the money that they've frittered away on transfers over the last few years, you know, in terms of just letting players go and not getting any transfer fee for them is incredible. And with Aubameyang, it's good to see him getting an opportunity to go somewhere else at least. And, you know, because he clearly wasn't going to have a way back into the first team at Arsenal after what had happened. And, you know, he probably fits in quite well at a madhouse like Barcelona.
It is a madhouse now, Barca, isn't it? I mean, next time we get Sid on, which is fascinating to see, you know, Traore and Aubameyang. And it's just sort of it's just weird that Barca are what Barca are now. Joe says, have Arsenal actually given up? Or are they about to embark on a 20-game winning streak, narrowly missing out on the World Series, but vindicating Brad Pitt's strategy and bringing him closer to his daughter. And oh, wait, no, that's the plot of Moneyball, he says. Jordan.
Yeah, there's so much anger amongst the Arsenal fan base around this particular window. And I get why. But if I'm going to kind of give the other perspective on what I'm assuming Arsenal are thinking, I don't think Arsenal are thinking that the top four this year was or is a possibility. They've obviously got a three-year plan where they're thinking that by the end of the third year, they'll be a comfortable top four team and they're sticking to their targets. Whereas they've almost stumbled into position now in January where top four is a possibility and the fan base is saying, well, just be a bit more ambitious, spend a bit more money and you can accelerate your process by 12 months and actually get into the top four this year rather than maybe next season. All the frustration about Aubameyang not being replaced and all that, I get that. But for me, the bigger issue at Arsenal is it's another top player that Arsenal have let go for free and got no money for. How many more players are Arsenal going to let go of and get minimal to no money for? You're looking at Ramsey, you're looking at Sanchez, you're looking at Ozil. They paid off Mustafi, Kolasinac. They're cutting contracts. And whilst on one side, I'm glad they're getting rid of the dead wood, and that's a very unfortunate phrase, but players that are never going to be a part of the future for Arsenal, I'm glad about that. They're clearing debts. On the other side, your business model must be an absolute shocker because you're just consistently paying people to leave your football club and big assets as well. Big assets, big players. And I think that's the bigger issue for me rather than the lack of replacing Aubameyang in this particular window. Because I think they tried to get Vlahovic and he just picked another team. The bigger issue for me is financially, when are you going to learn about money management?
Meanwhile, across North London, a double swoop by Tottenham, Rodrigo Bentancur, celebrated by scoring in the first minute for Uruguay. He was so excited to join Tottenham. And Dejan Kulusevski, they both come in from Juventus. Nikki Bandini, I messaged her to find out what she thought. And she says, I've been excited about both in the past, but not lately. So there you go. Kulusevski looked great at Parma. Bentancur started really well at Juventus, but went off the boil. And Ndombele's gone as well. I mean, I'm sad, Barney, about Ndombele not working out because, God, he was fun, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was, and he's fun. But the key thing about these signings is they all three of them seem to be things that you can demonstrably say, well, Antonio said he was happy with them. I mean, that seems to be, I mean, you know, he presumably knows both of these Juventus players and clearly didn't like Ndombele very much. So keeping Antonio happy is, or at least having a kind of paper trail where you can say it's not our fault, he's stormed off. It's, you know, look what we did everything we could, was presumably part of it. It all seems very Spursy to me. You know, there's always a hope that some of these signings will work out. You know, Brian Hill, yeah, maybe that'll work. You know, looks all right, doesn't he? I mean, he is really, he could have been playing for Spurs in 1987. He's so Spurs, it's incredible.
He's at Valencia now because one of the Weasley twins sent him there in the second weirdest video, not as good as Wout Weghorst and the Jurassic Park one to Burnley. Sorry, Ed, were you about to come in?
Yeah, I was just going to say Bentancur scored his first, it was his first ever goal for Uruguay.
Oh, was it?
Yeah, in his 47th appearance. I remember seeing him at the, I think it was when he was coming through, he's really, really rated as a player. And yeah, not being as convincing. But, you know, he's a regular for Uruguay, nearly got 50 caps now, so should strengthen that midfield. And Kuzalewski's, is an up-and-coming talent, so could fit in quite well. He's supposed to be a very nice guy as well.
Oh, that's important.
We've got an interesting story.
Which is?
I don't know it that well, to be honest, but he's supposed to be a very nice guy. I've seen a few interviews with him. And he just seems like a really nice bloke, and I kind of want him to do well. Oh, I don't know. He's from Sweden originally, but yeah, obviously has been in Italy for a couple of years.
Lots of West Ham fans disappointed with their inaction. They did try and get Calvin Phillips and Rafinha, but they seemed quite unlikely. Newcastle's quite sensible recruitment continued. Dan Byrne, Richard Jolly's stat, with the signing of Dan Byrne, Newcastle have the Premier League's tallest outfield player and shortest, with Dan Byrne and Ryan Fraser. So hopefully they will stand next to each other on many occasions. Matt Target coming in on loan until the end of the season. Do we think, Barney, this has been good? It's been good by Newcastle?
Yeah, I mean, it's great news for the Saudi Arabian private investment fund that they've finally secured. Matt Target, after years of being excluded from that sector of the global economy. We have targets, job completed. Now, I mean, they are good signings. They're good signings if they work, aren't they? It's hard to introduce a whole load of new players in one go, but these all look like people who know how to play in the league and are designed to fit certain sort of holes. I like Eddie Howe. Partly it's just because I find him quite exciting, the way he talks about stuff. I like his kind of urgency, but I think it's quite convincing what they've done so far in a football sense, and I'm absolutely certain they'll avoid relegation now.
Yeah, I think the word used earlier on, Max, is the right word, sensible. I don't know if they're good signings, but they're sensible signings, so much so that they've made me second guess whether I think they will go down now. I was adamant they were going down 3-4 weeks ago. Now I'm not so sure. I think they've given themselves a good chance. I think the Hodgson appointment at Watford, weirdly, makes me think they will stay up. Because I think of all the teams down there, Watford have got a lot of goals that are not being unleashed in that team. And if he can get their defence sorted, I think they've got a good chance. So I'm not totally convinced that Newcastle will stay up, but I'm a lot more now than I was before. But I think sensible is the word I would use to describe their window.
Christian Eriksen's gone to Brentford 7 months after he collapsed on the pitch at Euro 2020. Signed until the end of the season. It's a wonderful story. I mean, obviously, I imagine there's sort of some anxiety about watching him play football for the first time, Ed. But also a wonderful story for someone who, we did that pod that evening, and for a large part of that afternoon, we thought we'd saw him die, basically.
Yeah, and it's great to see him back, and obviously he's been forced into this kind of, by his position in Italy. He wasn't allowed to play in Serie A, so he had to end his contract over there. And Brentford is obviously the most obvious place for him to go, surrounded by people from Denmark. And Thomas Frank, he knows him very well. I think he coached him when he was much younger. And Brentford will take good care of him, you hope. And, but everybody is going to be holding their breath when he comes on for his first appearance. I'm sorry to say, it's just inevitable. But let's hope, that he can find his way back into playing regularly.
Aaron Ramsey, you and Murray's on tomorrow, but it was a big part of your piece, actually, Barney, about Ramsey. And sort of hadn't really noticed that he was earning quite that much money. Obviously, it's nothing to do with him, is it? But apart from he gets it, the lucky chap. But 400,000 a week, that's been, they've said that might not be that much, but if he's good still, that's quite a signing.
There's been some sort of rowing back on what the actual figures on his salary are. It feels a bit weird talking about this, but again, it's essentially public money, so why not? If he is on £400,000 a week, he will have earned £50 million since he's been at Juventus, during which he's barely, he won a league title medal as part of that team, but he's barely interacted with the team. It's not his fault. It's a ridiculous system that's the case. It seems wrong to me. I know it's not fashionable to talk about footballer salaries and say that's too much money. It is too much money. I personally don't think anybody should be earning more money than they can afford anywhere in society.
You're covering his wages as well, aren't they, I think, at Rangers?
I think Rangers are paying a bit.
But majority.
You're subsidising this player to go and... if he's anywhere near form, he'll be amazing in that league. He's a really good player. And so what happens when he scores 15 goals and they win the Scottish Premiership? Do Juve get a medal? Do they get to kind of keep the trophy in their cabinet?
Jermaine Defoe has signed for Sunderland till the end of the season, 39. So that'll be fun for League One centre-backs. And Ed Woodward left Manchester United yesterday. Producer Joel writes, what are your favourite Ed Woodward memories? That's a lovely question.
What was that ice cream partner that they got? That was a good day.
That was a good day. Great with tyres, isn't he, Ed Woodward? Mm. What will his legacy be? Anyway, questions for another day. That'll do for part two. Part three, we'll talk about AFCON football that's actually happened. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. So we know the semi-finals of AFCON, Burkina Faso against Senegal, Wednesday. 7 o'clock, Cameroon, Egypt on Thursday. Cameroon got past Gambia and Egypt beat Morocco. A lot of people, Ed, were saying on the previous pod that whoever wins the Egypt-Morocco game will go on to win it. But fascinating to see how those two will go against each other.
Yeah, I'm not so sure about that because, I mean, Egypt did brilliantly to hang on in that one and get through. It was actually, I mean, a lot of these tournaments and the matches always build as the big Premier League superstar against the other Premier League superstar. But in this case, it was Mohamed Salah that really dragged them through to the semis against a really good Morocco team, actually, who I think, you know, will be back maybe at the World Cup. And yeah, I mean, it's as I said, it's looking like a lot of people are going to be billing it potentially as Mane v Salah in the final. But I think Cameroon are the team to stop. Actually, being it's actually no one really knows exactly how long they are unbeaten at home for in a competitive game. Well, I'm sure somebody does, but there's a bit of confusion about it. Like some people are saying it dates back to the 70s, which is quite a long time, obviously. So if somebody's going to get the better of them at home, it's you know, going to be a special effort from Egypt in the semis, and then Burkina Faso v Senegal in the other semi should be an amazing game. Burkina Faso have got some really, really good young players coming through. Both their centre backs are like take free kicks and penalties, and have been absolutely brilliant so far. So yeah, I'm looking forward to both games. I think it's been a really good tournament so far.
Would you go along with that, Jordan? How have you enjoyed it? that much?
Yeah, I wouldn't say I've loved it. I mean, it took a while to kind of get going, and that there were reasons as to why that was. I think the fans getting into the grounds and filling up stadiums has been a problem, I think, for COVID reasons and for, you know, financial reasons as well, ticket prices being just expensive. So in terms of atmosphere, I think it started a bit flat. I think it's got going now. Whenever big nations go out of a major tournament, that always kind of, I think, really kicks into gear a tournament. So seeing the likes of Nigeria and Ghana go out relatively early, I thought, you know, was interesting. Senegal's a team that I've backed from the start, only because I was there on holiday 6 weeks ago. So I've got a recent link with that particular nation. The quality's been okay. I'm not going to pretend it's been amazing. It's been okay. But yeah, I've watched it, but I've not watched it and focused on it 100% because of the enjoyment. I'm watching it more so to spot new talent and see emerging nations.
Jim says, thoughts on referees having their names on their back as they have done in the AFCON knockout games? How could certain prominent referees, basically Mike Dean, further build their brand awareness? I hadn't spotted this, Barney. Presumably this is a great move for football for referees to have their names on their backs.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of hard to sort of unpack, isn't it? I mean, football's divided into two people who know the names of every single referee and know their litany of crimes against particular teams. And people like me who just don't know who they are. My mind blocks them. I don't want to know what this referee is, or I don't want to know his name. They shouldn't list their names. I don't care. I don't care who he is or what he did before. Kevin Friend always does this. It shouldn't be a thing. You shouldn't know who they are. It should be just like a butcher from Burnley who is doing this and never speaks and then just goes and you don't even know who he was. Don't stop knowing who referees are.
Derek says, were any other listeners shitting themselves driving last week when Jonathan Wilson was discussing AFCON? After about 15 minutes of complete paranoia that I was dragging a dog by the lead along the motorway, I eventually realised the car horns were coming from the podcast. Yeah, he was outside his hotel window in Cameroon. It was very beepy. So you weren't the only person, Derek, to send that. Several Canadians have been in touch. Kian, hello from a loyal Canadian listener. I was quite surprised when an American listener accused the pod of having an anti-American bias when not discussing Pulisic's goal against Liverpool. Perhaps in the spirit of inclusion, the pod would like to discuss Pulisic's performance as the American golden generation was beaten 2-0 by a Alphonso Davis-less Canada to send them 4 points clear of the Americans at the top of the CONCACAF qualifying standings. Yeah, they beat the US 2-0. Kyle Larin scored more goals than any other Canadian man. Got the opener after 7 minutes. Sam Adekugbe, born in London, moved to Canada age 10. He got the second in injury time, took it brilliantly. Alphonso Davies was watching with his dad. I think they were streaming on Twitch or something. And when the goal went in injury time in the 95th minute, they both went absolutely wild. And their goalkeeper is a guy called Milan Borjan. Michael says, dispatch from Canada for the pod. Following the Canadian men's 2-0 win over the USA in frigid Hamilton, Ontario, Canadian keeper Milan Borjan has had his sweatpants added into the Canadian Soccer Hall of Fame, Gabor Kirilli style. Yeah, he's wearing tracksuit trousers. A lot of chest pumping. One brilliant save from a header from a corner. He's the captain of Red Star Belgrade, born in the former Yugoslavia. In the Balkan crisis, his family fled to Belgrade, eventually emigrated to Canada, where he went to secondary school. Lots of very happy Canadians. So, congratulations to you. Barney and Jordan, you both watched Bolivia 2, Chile 3, didn't you? Did you enjoy the pitch was fantastic, Barney.
Yeah, I'm really glad someone else has obscure television channels down the end of the dial as well.
Well, to be fair, I was at a pub last night and it was in the background, so I was watching.
Okay, well, that's much better than that's much better than me. You've done me there. I was at home watching the obscure channel I subscribed to for some game ages ago and still have. But it was brilliant. Like, the pitch was terrible. It was really wet. People always struggle, obviously, at altitude. Everybody looked exhausted after an hour. Alexis Sanchez scored twice and was brilliant, actually. He could have had a hat-trick, hit the bar. It went back to 3-2 in the last minute. There's loads of stoppage time. It was fantastic. Maybe football should always be like that. It had these really grainy pictures, like it was from the 1980s or something.
Yes, I've written it looked very 1986. Everything about it looked 1986 to me. It was great, wasn't it? I mean, the high point of CONMEBOL qualifying is the linesman having to start Chile's World Cup qualifier against Argentina. They left their flags at home, so they had to use high-vis jackets tied to cut-off broom handles to run the line. What I find the most amazing thing about this is, fair enough, one referee's assistant forgets their flag, but like for both of them to do it, unless, I don't know how this works. I mean, is one assistant like the head assistant and is in charge of the props, and the other one just carry nothing? How does it work that?
No, the ref normally brings the flags.
So the ref brings the assistants don't carry the flag. They turn up with nothing. It's like
in grassroots. So that's what happens. The ref gives me a flag, and I have to give it to a parent normally.
You're the middleman. You're the mule. You're the flag.
Worst case scenario, do it yourself.
Do your own back four and never, give offside all the time.
Yeah, well, that's
isn't it. But anyway, that's it. Broom handles. It reminds me of doing a phone in on. When the referee didn't have a whistle, of which the high points were one forgetting the whistle and using a harmonica, one using a metal tray and a spoon. Paul Hawksby tells a story of a ref who got locked in a dressing room, and it was one of those windows that only opened a little bit, but he said he could still see enough of the pitch to peek his head out of the window and blow his whistle through the window. And there's an infamous, no longer referees anymore, but in Manchester Sunday League, there was a referee that if it was really wet, he would drive his car to the halfway line and beep his horn for a foul and then indicate which way the decision would go. So anyway, I'm all in favour of those. Alistair says, what's going on with the Socceroos? Are they going to miss out on the World Cup? Joey, an Australian man, says, can a nation retrospectively claim to be boycotting Qatar in the event that they don't qualify? A 2-2 draw with Oman was pretty bleak for Australia, and their chances of getting through are slim. And in my experience of being in Australia for 6 months, the football world is perennially having an existential crisis about every part of the game. How good is the A-League? Is it as good as this league or that league? Everything is in crisis pretty much the whole time. Matildas had a terrible result as well. And someone got in touch about UEFA suing a pizzeria in a German city of Gießen for naming their mushroom pizza Champignons League. For Rob Harris, though, from AP, saying UEFA obviously, this is a quote from UEFA, UEFA obviously takes the protection of its intellectual property seriously, but this instance seems to be a case of an overzealous local trademark agent acting too hastily. The UEFA Champions League can happily live alongside this delicious sounding pizza. So that is, it's got a nice, it's a frozen pizza, sort of vacuum packed with a nice looking sort of man with a sort of Italian hat with the Italian flag on it and a big moustache with a thumb pointing next to Champignons League. James says, does anyone have a better tenuous link to the pod? Ed and his dad took me to my first match at Selhurst Park 32 years ago on the 20th of January 1990. Rush and Beardsley scored. For some reason, it swapped my allegiance to Palace from Liverpool. My life could have been so different. James B. Do you remember James B, Ed?
I have to say that I do. But I don't know. I'm not sure. That's taking me completely unaware. That's great to have played a role in someone's football.
How can you? How many people did you take to Selhurst Park when you were 10?
There's been many.
Really?
God, it's been so
poor
many,
old unmemorable. So many years. Poor old unmemorable.
No, I do remember him. I do.
You don't at all.
I.
We got some reaction to the crypto NFT pod that we did on Monday. Mainly people saying they still don't understand what it is. Mr. Brown says, could you and Barry do a beginner's guide to the beginner's guide? I didn't understand a word of it. Gordon says, can I buy some Guardian Football Weekly fan tokens, please? I listened to the program last night. It was quite mind-bending. A return to topics such as what is a half volley and Steve Bruce to Burnley, please. Andy Robertson has joined the NFT game. He's the latest one. He posted the tweet, turned the replies off shortly afterwards. Producer Joel has made a fan token of Barry as an NFT. So we'll see what that goes for. And finally, can we all send our best wishes to Halvor E. Granerud, the Norwegian ski jumper, friend of the pod, as he sets off for Beijing. He sent a photo from the aeroplane where he's changed his screensaver on his phone to Barry holding Norman the dog, who I think is a dog, frequents the same local pub as Barry. So all Guardian listeners, we have a competitor in the ski jump. Presumably he'll have your phone with Barry's face hurtling down. Could you film it, please? That's who we're supporting.
It's an absolutely thrilling sport, Max. I have to say I've found myself watching ski jumping a couple of times in recent weeks. And it's amazing. If you haven't watched it before,
everybody's watched ski jumping before, surely. Like, of course, we've all watched it.
Yeah. If you haven't watched it for a while, they've now got a sort of, you know, behind the camera, behind the jumper.
Oh, okay.
That follows the jumper as he takes off.
Oh, really? Is that incredible. Just a cameraman on skis with a or is it a drone? Or what's happened?
I don't think it's a cameraman. Okay. I'll tell you. I think it's probably a robot.
Oh, awful if they sped up and got quicker than the ski jumper and then had to sort of turn around. Yes, Jordan?
Just before you end the pod, I was on a date about 3 weeks ago at a bar in King's Cross.
Okay. How did it go?
Very well. We'll talk about that, but very, very
okay.
well.
Okay, fine.
Two gentlemen approached me just randomly while I was talking to this young woman, and they said, are you Jordan Jarrett Bryant from the Guardian Football Weekly pod? And I was like, yeah. And they said they loved the podcast, they loved Barry, they loved you, and I promised I'd give them a shout out. I've forgotten their names.
Okay.
But the two gentlemen that approached me in the pub in King's Cross, there's your shout out. They love the podcast.
I hope it wasn't James B, who's been forgotten again since going to Selhurst Park with Ed Ahrens. I was hoping they'd be Aston Villa fans going, we love everything except you, Jordan.
It's amazing how people do recognise you from the pod.
That was my first question. How the hell did you know it was me?
Well, people somehow do. I remember being in a tent with Kevin McCarra in 2008 and somebody coming up to me, an Austrian man coming up to him and saying, you are Kevin McCarra from the Guardian Football Weekly podcast. And it happens time and time again. It's the only place people actually ever, I guess people actually listen to it maybe. It's good. Hello, everyone.
I'm continually surprised. I should actually apologise to. I was jogging and I run out of football shirts, so I put a shirt on, which was given to me, and it has my name on the back. It says Max 9, and somebody cycled past me while I was jogging, and then looked round and waved at me quite recently down the sort of the cycle pedestrian pathway on St George's Road in Melbourne. And I thought it was quite embarrassing that he would think I would often go jogging with my own name on the back of my shirt. And I was embarrassed, but he was cycling too fast and it was 33 degrees, so I couldn't really catch up with him. But anyway, we are surprised that people listen, but we are thankful. And that seems like a good place to end this one. Barney, thanks, mate.
Thank you.
Thanks, Ed.
Thanks, Max.
Cheers, Jordan.
Anytime.
We'll be back tomorrow.
This is The Guardian.